Harvey kept an office just off Logan Square, on the second floor of a brownstone he shared with the Chase Bank. I drove us past the building and then around the square twice in Nicodemus's black town car, using the time to think. It was a sunny morning, promising a mild spring day. "You are literally driving in circles," Gray noted from the passenger seat. "Harvey shares a building with a bank," I pointed out. Gray made an unhappy sound.
"What difference does that make?" Deirdre asked from the back seat.
"They'll have at least one armed guard on site," Gray said, "and probably more than one. Additionally, everyone there will have rapid access to alarms that will summon the local constabulary."
"Then we'll take him quickly and go," Deirdre said.
"A broad daylight kidnapping," I said, "in view of all this foot traffic, bank customers, and..." Even as I spoke, a white sedan with blue and white bubs and a sky-blue horizontal stripe rolled through on the opposite side of the square's roundabout. "And Chicago PD patrol cars, which regularly prowl through here." Gray sighed. "He's right. We're gonna have to be patient." "Can't keep circling the square," I said, pulling off. "We'll hit the next street over, try to find some place we can park that gives us a view of the building." Deirdre scowled at me in the rearview mirror.
"The simplest way is to walk in, kill him silently, and take what we need. No one will be the wiser until the body is discovered."
"Point," Gray said. "Simple, all right," I said. "I mean, we don't know his schedule today, who's coming to his office, where he's expected to be, who might raise a cry if he goes missing, or anything like that, but why let inconvenient little things like facts slow us down?" Deirdre's scowl turned into a glower. Her hair whipped back and forth a few times, like an agitated cat thrashing its tail. I ignored her and drove slowly down the street on the other side of the bank building. It was early enough that I managed to find a parking space with a view of Harvey's office door, and I wedged the town car inexpertly into it.
"There's his car," Gray noted, as I did. "Our man comes in to work early.
Maybe he loves his job."
"How tiresome," Gray said. He settled back in his seat with his odd eyes half-closed and unfocused.
"So," Deirdre asked, "what are we going to do?"
"Await developments," Gray said. "Harvey will leave eventually," I said, "to get lunch, if nothing else. We'll follow him until he's somewhere a little less likely to result in alarms and swarms of cops." Deirdre didn't like that.
"We are on a schedule."
"I guess Daddy should have thought of that before he decided to proceed without telling anyone his plans," I said. "We could have gotten started days ago."
"Patience, Miss Auclion," Gray advised, barely moving his lips as he spoke.
He had the look of someone who was comfortable with the idea of spending a lot of time waiting. The man had worked stakeouts before.
"We have a little time, and we can always do it the direct way should we need to change our minds."
And we waited.
"Why?"
Gray asked me abruptly a couple of silent hours later.
"Why what?" I asked.
I needed a bathroom break, but I didn't want to wander off and take the chance that the two of them would roll up and kill Harvey the minute I wasn't looking.
"This man is no one to you," Gray said. "Why does it matter if he lives or dies?"
"Because killing people isn't right," I said. Gray smiled slightly.
"No," he said, "I'm being serious."
"So am I," I said.
"A random hard point of irrational morality?" he asked. "I've heard your reputation, Dresden. You don't mind killing."
"If I've got to, I will," I said. "If I don't have to do it, I don't. Besides, it's smarter." Gray opened his eyes all the way and turned his head toward me.
"Smarter?"
"You kill someone, there's always someone close to them who's going to take it hard," I said. "Maybe a lot of someones. You remove one enemy, but you make three more."
"Do you honestly think Harvey has someone ready to avenge him should we take his life?" Gray asked.
"He's got whoever he works for," I pointed out. "And he's got the cops and the FBI. If we make a corpse of him, we risk warning our target and setting large forces in motion that could skew this whole deal."
"Kill them as well," Deirdre said sullenly.
"I thought we were on a schedule," I snapped back at her waspishly.
I turned to Gray again. "The point is, killing someone is almost never the smart move, long term. Sometimes it's got to be done if you want to survive, but the more you do it, the more you risk creating more enemies and buying yourself even more trouble.
Gray seemed to consider that for a moment and then shrugged.
The argument is not entirely without merit. Tell me, Wizard, does it give you some sort of satisfaction to protect this man?
Yeah. He lifted his eyebrows.
Good. You want to keep him alive now, I said. It's just possible that I might have sounded sarcastic. That was easy.
Gray resumed his waiting posture, eyes slipping out of focus again.
It doesn't matter to me either way. I've no objection to killing for professional reasons, and no need to do it when doing so would be stupid.
I thought you said it would be fun. That made Gray bare his teeth in a smile.
Always. But just because something is pleasurable doesn't mean it is appropriate.
Look, Deirdre said, her voice suddenly intent. I did. Three people in overcoats were walking up to Harvey's building. They skipped the entrance in front and headed for the staircase and back. Two of them were men, fairly bulky. The third was a petite woman. All three moved with a clarity and intensity of purpose that marked them as predators.
Poaches, Gray noted.
There was a low, growling tone to his voice. I peered at the woman a little more closely and shot Deirdre a look over my shoulder.
Is that?
Her eyes were wide. She nodded tightly.
My mother.
Fantastic. Polonius Lartessa was another knight of the Blackened Denarius, the bearer of Amariel. She was also Nicodemus's estranged wife, a sorceress, and an all-around piece of bad news.
What's she doing here? I demanded.
Deirdre stared intently at the woman.
I'm not sure. She's supposed to be in Iran. She wasn't supposed to know that—
Deirdre cut herself off abruptly. So, the wife was cutting in on Nicodemus's action, assuming Deirdre was telling the truth, which I couldn't.
We can't let her take the factor from us, Gray said calmly.
He unbuckled his seatbelt and got out of the car. Come on. Deirdre bit her lip, but then she got out, following Gray, and I went with them.
Chapter 17.
Gray, I said, hurrying to catch up.
Huh?
How is walking up and starting a fight with Tessa any better than doing it with Harvey?
It isn't, he said. But the alternative may be losing him. Unacceptable.
Then we don't lose him, I said. How good is your Nicodemus impersonation? Gray narrowed his metallic eyes.
What did you have in mind?
You two go up and distract them, I said. One big happy family. I go in the front door and get Harvey the hell out of there, quietly.
Gray considered it for a moment and then nodded once.
I doubt I'll be able to fool his wife for more than a moment, but then you only need a moment.
Deirdre grimaced.
Just press your lips together as hard as you can and keep quiet. He gets like that when he's angry. I'll talk.
Gray's mouth turned up into a grin, then he winked at me and just melted. 1 second, the plain man in jeans and an athletic jacket was there. The next, it was Nicodemus. Head to toe, black suit and all. And not just in appearance. Gray's posture changed, along with his walk, the way he held his head, right down to the smug, wary eyes.
Why, thank you, Deirdre, he said in a perfect imitation of Nicodemus's gravelly voice. Such a dear child.
Deirdre stared at Gray for a second in something between fascination and disgust. Then she said to me,
Hurry, Amariel will realize Anduriel isn't there before long.
I nodded and took off at a jog. I vaulted a large cast-iron fence behind the building,
parkour,
and hustled down an alley no wider than my shoulders between the bank building and its neighbor, keeping the bank between me and the approach of Tessa and her goons, the way a squirrel will circle and hide behind the trunk of a tree. I stopped at the corner to check and be sure that they'd gone out of sight, found the coast clear, then ran down the length of the front side of the bank and went up the stairs to Harvey's office, 3 steps at a time. The front door had a simple logo on it that read, Morrison Fiduciary Services. I went on in and found myself in an office decorated with tastefully Spartan sensibilities. There was a receptionist's desk, though no one was at it, and an open door leading into what was obviously a working office.
"Just a moment," called a man from the other room. "I'll be right with you."
I didn't give him a moment. The way the office was laid out, the rear entrance had to be opened directly into Harvey's office, and Tessa and company might appear there any time. Harvey's office was as elegant as his entry, but more crowded with the tools of his trade, computers and office equipment and bookshelves and files. The man himself sat behind the desk with his shirt sleeves rolled up, hunched over a computer keyboard, fingers flying as he watched figures and diagrams of some kind rolling by on his screen. No sooner did I set foot in the office than the computer started making an odd buzzing noise, and the scent of scorched insulation filled the air. An instant later, Harvey's screen turned blue, covered in white text.
"What?" he said, baffled.
Then he slapped the side of the monitor and repeated,
"What? You have got to be kidding me."
He turned his gaze toward me, annoyance all over his face, and suddenly froze as he saw my expression and my quarterstaff.
He said, "Who the hell are you?"
"Come with me if you want to live," I said.
"Excuse me."
"No time," I said. "It isn't your fault, but you're into some bad business, Harvey. There's a woman with two hired goons about to come up your back steps, and they aren't here to sell you a magazine subscription."
"What?" he said. "Do you have an appointment?"
"Are you freaking kidding me?" I growled and stalked over to his desk.
"Get up and come with me."
"Now, see here, young man," Harvey stammered. "I will not be ordered about in my own place of business. If you do not leave immediately, I will summon the authorities."
There just wasn't time for this dance, so I stepped around his desk, grabbed his upper arm in my left hand, and hauled him to his feet.
"Take your hands off of me at once," he shouted.
"I'm trying to help you," I told him, dragging him back out into the front room by main force.
"You're going to thank me for this later."
The front door opened, and two more goons stepped into the office, different men from the ones Tessa had with her.
Damn it! I hadn't been keeping an eye out for them on the way in. Of course, if we'd thought to cover both exits, Tessa and her people would have done the same.
The two men saw us and immediately plunged their hands into their jackets, going for their shoulder holsters.
I was quicker. I thrust Harvey behind me with my left hand and pointed my staff at the two men with my right, summoning up a burst of will and snarling,
"Forzare!"
The runes carved into the staff flared into a pale green-white light, and a wave of force caught both men. One of them was slapped against the wall hard enough to dent the drywall, while the other went reeling back out the door and was thrown down the steps. The thug who hit the drywall was tough. He bounced off it, completed drawing his silenced pistol, dropped to a knee, and aimed at Harvey. No time to pull together a shield, not without the advantage of a specialized magical tool to make it happen. So I spun, putting my back between the shooter and Harvey, bowed my head forward as far as I could, and hunched my shoulders. The gun coughed, clack, 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 slugs smashed against my back, only to be defeated by the painstaking protective energies I had spellwrought into the leather duster I wore. I counted 8 hits, all of which felt like taking a Little League fastball to the back, painful but not debilitating. Then the gun fell silent, and I heard the metallic click of a magazine being released. I whirled and slashed the end of my staff at the gunman. The heavy oak smashed against the wrist of his gun hand, and knocked away the fresh magazine he'd been about to load. I followed up with a backswing and hit him on the jaw right below his ear and sent him sprawling to the floor, the gun tumbling free. I kicked the gun away from him and hauled Harvey to his feet. He was staring at the downed gunman, aghast.
That man just tried to kill you.
No, I said. He just tried to kill you.
Seriously, dude, what part of come with me if you want to live did you not understand?
I hauled Harvey along with me again, and this time he wasn't resisting me. We headed for the door just as the sound of breaking glass cut in from the office.
What was that? He panted.
Trouble, I said. Hurry. I led the way, staff in hand, a shield spell ready to leap into reality if the second gunman proved to be waiting for us, but there was no sign of him.
You're in pretty good shape, Harvey, I said as I led him down the stairs. You a jogger, by any chance?
He said, I swim and do yoga.
No, Harvey, I said, you run.
You run marathons every morning before breakfast. Make me believe it. Move. I broke into a run down the sidewalk, dodging a little bit of foot traffic now and then. Harvey hurried to keep up, breathing harder than was strictly warranted by the exercise. We'd gotten past the bank and to the next strip of brownstone buildings before I heard a shout behind me. Tessa had appeared in the doorway to Harvey's office. She focused on me, and even from that distance, I could feel the malice in her gaze. She pointed a finger at me, and two goons took up the chase. I ducked down the next alley between buildings, circling back toward where I hoped Gray and Deirdre would be waiting to give me some backup, but they were not to be found. As I looked, I saw Tessa emerge from the back door of Harvey's office and begin hurrying after us. There wasn't much foot traffic on this block, and I saw Tessa shuck out of her overcoat on the run. In another moment, she'd take her demonic form and close in on us. If she was truly out to disrupt her husband's plans, Tessa wasn't worried about causing a scene. If she could stir up the city's police forces, so much the better. She'd happily become that hideous bug thing she'd turned into and rip Harvey's skull apart. "Damn it!" I said, fleeing down the street, away from Harvey's office and my compatriots. I didn't have much choice. Tessa had me outnumbered. I might have been able to take my chances in a fight with her and some armed thugs, but I couldn't fight them and protect Harvey at the same time. If I stood my ground, they'd take him. So I ran to buy myself some time to think. As I did, I realized that I didn't have to beat them in a fight. All I had to do was stall them, or hold them off long enough for Deirdre and Gray to catch up with me. While I didn't trust either of my companions to give a damn about me, they needed Harvey to carry out the plan. And the farther I ran, the more likely it was that I might accidentally lose my own backup. We reached a building that had been abandoned. Its windows were boarded up and covered with graffiti. It would have to do. I whirled toward it, unleashed another blast of energy from my staff, and blew a hole the size of a garbage can in the plywood and the glass beyond. "Come on," I said. "Stay close." "What are you doing?" "We're playing hide-and-seek," I said, and lunged into the building. Harvey stared, slack-jawed at me for a second, but then glanced back toward Tessa. His face went pale, and his eyes widened. He made a few strangled noises, and then thrust himself through the hole, almost sprawling into the broken glass. I caught him and set him on his feet. The building had been a retail store of some kind, and most of it was one large room. There were still clothing racks scattered around the place, along with the detritus of long-term abandonment. The only light came in around the edges of its boarded-up windows and through the hole I'd blasted. Shadows crawled everywhere. I headed deeper into the building, stumbling blindly over things on the floor while my eyes struggled to shift from the light of the spring morning to the gloom of the store's interior. I almost ran into a wall before I saw it, but once I had, I was able to make out just enough shapes to realize that the shop had a doorway leading back to some restrooms and what were probably managerial offices of some kind. I pushed Harvey into the hallway, then stepped into the doorway between him and the rest of the shop, raising my staff to the horizontal and preparing a shield spell. It wasn't anything like ideal, but it was a better defensive position than I could get on the street outside. They'd all have to come at me from the same direction. "Stay low," I advised him. "Don't go anywhere."
"We should be running," he panted. "Shouldn't we? Calling the police?"
"Cops got better things to do than to get killed," I said. He blinked.
"What? Seriously, you don't recognize that reference either? Hell's bells, Harvey, do you even go to the movies?"
Shadows moved in the shaft of light provided by my impromptu portal, and figures entered the abandoned store. Three gunmen, then four, and then something that might have been a praying mantis, only hundreds of times too large, complete with googly, faceted bug eyes and a second set of glowing green eyes open above them. It took Tessa only a second to spot me. Then she darted toward me over the floor, moving with terrible insect-like speed, and I triggered the shield spell. The runes on my staff flared green-white again, and a fine curtain of blue-green light washed out from the oak, covering the doorway. Tessa stopped in front of it, maybe 10 feet away. Then she pointed at the door with one long leg and said, in a perfectly normal human voice, "Open fire." The gunman didn't hesitate.
Their silenced weapons went clickety-clack, and sparks and flashes of light bounced up from my shield where the bullets struck. Foiling them wasn't a terrible strain. Subsonic ammunition is slow-moving by its very nature, and each individual round carried considerably less force when it struck than it would have at full speed. "Hold," the mantis thing said. The gunman stopped firing. The giant bug stared at me for a long moment, then its jaws opened and opened and opened some more, and Tessa's face and head emerged from its mouth, flaccid chitin peeling back like a hood. Her skin and hair were covered in some kind of glistening slime. She was an odd one to look at. She didn't look like she could be out of her teens when she didn't have wardrobe to lend her its gravitas, and her apparent youth was magnified by the fact that she was a tiny woman under 5 feet tall. She was pretty, the high school girl next door. Of course, she'd been walking the earth for more than a millennium before there were any high schools.
"Hello, Dresden," Tessa said.
"Hi, Tessa," I replied.
"The upright hero Harry Dresden," she said, "working for Nicodemus Arcleon.
Did Lashiel finally talk you into taking up her coin?" "Pretty sure you know that she didn't," I said. She shrugged one shoulder. The motion was absolutely eerie on her insectoid body.
"True.
But I cannot imagine what else might compel a man like you to work for the likes of my husband." "Long story," I said.
"Now go away."
She shook her head.
"I can't do that, I'm afraid. You have something I want. I want you to give it to me."
"It would never work out for us," I said sadly. "I'd be too worried about you biting my head off afterward to live in the moment."
"Don't flatter yourself," she said.
"Give the mortal to me.
Make me take him from you, and you will share his fate."
"Who are you?"
Harvey asked in a shaking, bewildered voice.
"What on earth have I done to you?"
Tessa clicked her tongue.
"Don't trouble yourself with such questions, little man. You won't have them for very much longer."
"Oh, God,"
Harvey said. "I'll make you a deal," I said. "Walk away, and I won't call the Orkin man." In reply, she lifted an insect leg and hissed a word. A shaft of rotten-looking greenish light streaked toward my shield. I gritted my teeth and held it steady, turning back the attack, feeling the strain of holding the shield beginning to build.
"This isn't a negotiation," she said. "You've already lost. You're trapped, and you can't keep that shield up forever. Give him to me, and I will grant you safe passage."
She was right, of course. I couldn't hold the shield forever, or even for long. The moment it dropped, she and her boys would cut loose with everything they had, and that would be that. She might or might not be sincere about the offer of free passage, but if she was... if she was... then this was my chance to derail Nicodemus's heist. If Tessa, one of Nicodemus's own circle, interfered and overpowered me, that wouldn't be my fault. I could end this mess and get out while still preserving Mab's reputation. Mab would applaud this solution. And all I had to do was let Tessa kill Harvey. No, I wasn't ready to hand over anyone to one of the monsters if I could help it. I might have made some bad choices along the way, but I wasn't that far gone. Besides, I couldn't trust her word anyway. She was just as likely to kill me for the fun of it as to let me walk away in one piece.
"Why don't you go back to the roach motel you crawled out of?" I replied.
She shook her head and sighed.
"Such a waste of potential."
Then she turned her head to one of her minions and nodded.
"Take them both."
The gunmen did something I hadn't expected at that point. They dropped their weapons and started shucking out of their coats and jackets. As they did, they began to jerk and contort. Joints popped and flesh rippled. Their shirts distended as their shoulders hunched to inhuman proportions and their faces stretched out into almost canine muzzles, teeth extending into fangs and tusks. their hands thickened and lengthened, with long claws extending from their tips.
"Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God,"
Harvey whispered, his breath coming in panicked gasps.
"What is that?"
"Ghouls," I said grimly. "Strong, fast, hard to kill."
"What are they going to do?"
"Rip through the walls, come at us from all sides, kill us, and eat us," I said. And, in professional silence, the ghouls started ripping at the drywall on both sides of my defensive position in the doorway to do exactly that. Chapter 18. Tearing through drywall is a surprisingly noisy process. It breaks with loud, crunching, snapping noises. Ghouls have been known to claw their way through inches of stone mausoleum wall to get to a nice rotten corpse to eat, and they had very little trouble with the drywall and wood, their claws and hunched shoulders ripping through it at a steady pace. We had maybe 60 seconds at most before they would be romping through the wall and into the building on either side of us.
"They're coming,"
Harvey gasped.
"They're going to get us. What do we do?"
My own heart was beating a lot faster than it had been a moment ago. Ghouls were no joke. And a close, confined space like this was the worst possible situation in which a wizard could take them on. My spell-armored duster wouldn't be of much help when one of them was chewing on my head. It doesn't matter how many times you face danger. When your life is under threat, and you know it, you're scared. End of story. Fear, real, silvery, adrenaline-charged fear, rocketed through me. I said, not panicking. I was going to say back up, I really was, but Tessa was staring at me with a smug, gloating expression on her face, and I was suddenly infuriated. Tessa was special. The last time I'd seen her, she'd put a good man in the hospital for months and left him permanently maimed. It was a miracle, literally, that he'd lived at all. She hurt my friend. The winter surged up inside me in time with my rage, and I suddenly put a much higher priority on the fact that I still owed her for that. "Get behind me and stay close," I growled instead.
"What?"
Harvey blurted. I had the satisfaction of seeing Tessa's gloating expression falter for a fraction of a second, tipped off by something in my face, maybe, before I dropped my shield, extended my staff in my right hand, called upon Winter, and snarled,
"Infriga!"
A howl of arctic air billowed out onto the display floor, blanketing every object in it, the floor, the ceiling, and the walls, in an instant layer of flash frost. The sudden shift in temperature condensed the air into frozen mist, a fog thick enough to cut visibility to 5 or 6 feet. A situation that would be much more to the advantage of the team with fewer members, making it harder for the enemy to coordinate their superior numbers. I strode forward through the fog, closing the distance on Tessa so that I could get her in sight again before she recovered and started maneuvering on me. In a perfect world, I would have found her frozen into a block of bitterly cold winter ice, but she was a sorceress and not a dime store amateur either. As I came in sight through the fog, I saw her stumbling back, her foremost insect arms crossed in a defensive gesture, her image blurry on the other side of a C-shaped wall of ice that had not quite managed to engulf her entirely. I gestured with a staff and snarled,
"Forzare!"
The frozen wall exploded into chunks and shards of knife-edged crystalline ice, as deadly as a cloud of shrapnel. She tried to fling herself to one side, but stunned by the intensity of the attack, she didn't account for the ice-coated tile floor beneath her legs, floor that provided me with footing as sure and solid as a basketball court. Insect legs skittered wildly, and the ice tore into her chitin-covered body, sending splatters of dark green ichor everywhere, even as the mantis head half-slithered up over her human face, swallowing it down again. Hotly glowing green eyes opened above the insectoid mantis eyes of Tessa's demon form, blazing with immortal rage, and as the swirling mists closed around them, the eyes of Tessa's patron fallen angel were all that I could see of her.
"Hey, Amario," I snarled. "I've got some for you, too."
"Fuego!"
As I spoke the words, I hurled the fusion of my will and elemental flame through my staff, imbuing the spell that ran through it with the silver-white fire of creation itself. A basketball-sized comet of blazing soul fire soared through the air like a chord of triumphant choir music and detonated upon those glowing eyes in thunder and fury, in steam and even more mist. The eyes vanished in time with a tea kettle scream of hellish fury and a thunderous crash of shattering brick from the far end of the building. That bought me a little time, at least. I whirled and dragged Harvey behind me, just as the quickest or luckiest of the ghouls loomed out of the mist and flung itself bodily at my head. No time for a spell, no need for one. With the full power of winter still singing through my limbs, I whirled my heavy oaken quarterstaff and met the leaping ghoul with a strike that used the full power of my arms, shoulders, hips, and legs. I struck it across one shoulder, and there was a wet, sickening crack of breaking bone and limbs being torn out of joint. I hammered the ghoul to the floor with the same blow, as if it had been an overeager kitten jumping at me, and drew a yowling shriek of surprised anguish from it as it landed. My mind flashed to a pair of young wizards, brother and sister, tormented to death by ghouls on my watch a few years back, and I remembered that I owed them a debt, collectively as well. I kicked the downed ghoul hard enough to send it sliding away over the icy floor, and though it was already taxing my reserves to call up that kind of power, I again unleashed Winter, snarling, "Infriga!" The ghoul had no defenses against that kind of magic. An instant later, there was a white, vaguely ghoul-shaped block of ice where the creature had been. The block kept sliding, grinding over the icy floor, and fetched up against the clawed feet of the other three ghouls. The three stared at the block of ice for a startled quarter second, and then as one fixed me with hate-filled eyes and let out snarls of utter fury. Yikes! Time slowed down as they crouched to spring toward me. Entombing one ghoul in ice was one thing. Doing it to three of them was something else entirely. If I took the time to take out one of them, the other two would be upon me almost before the words had left my lips, and four ghouls minus two ghouls is two ghouls too many. When you're outnumbered as badly as I was, inflicting 2-to-1 casualties is just another way to say that you lost and got eaten. I had to change the footing of this fight. The ghoul on my left was a shade faster than his two fellows, and I sprang to my left, drawing him with me, creating a little more space between him and his companions. As his clawed feet left the ground, I gestured with my staff, calling upon Winter again and shouting, "Glossi Valari!" With a shriek, a sheet of ice 1.5 feet thick rose from floor to ceiling in a ruler-straight line cutting diagonally across the sails floor. The ice clipped the lead ghoul's heels as it shot upward, slamming into the ceiling in front of the other two with an ear-tearing, grinding noise. My timing had been solid. It was a one-on-one fight again. I felt a surge of triumph. That lasted for maybe 1/4 of a second, and then the leaping ghoul hit me like a professional linebacker, who was also a hungry cannibal. He slammed into me hard enough to break ribs, and I had to hope that the crackling sound I heard was shifting ice. We went down hard, with me on bottom, my duster now sliding over the hard surface, dispersing some of the energy of the hit. The ghoul knew exactly what it was doing. I'd tangled with them a few times before, and in a fight, ghouls are mostly all unfocused ferocity and brute strength, ripping and tearing at whatever they can reach. This one didn't do that. He got both hands on my staff, wrenching it aside with that hunched, fantastic strength, and ducked his head in close, going for my throat for the immediate kill. I knew enough about hand-to-hand fighting to recognize technique and discipline when I saw it. It was the difference in fighting a furious, drunken amateur and taking on a trained soldier or a champion mixed martial artist. Over the years, I'd picked up some technique of my own from Karen and the others. I provided an instant's resistance against the ghoul's wrenching of my quarterstaff, then released it as I doubled up my body, pushing the ghoul up as hard as I could with my legs, trying to shove him to one side.
I didn't fling him off me or anything, but simultaneously taking his balance and giving him a solid impetus in a new direction let me dump him to the ice just as his jaws began to snap closed on my throat. I felt a flash of sensation there as his weight vanished, and I rolled frantically in the opposite direction, using the momentum of the push to get me going. I came to my feet, a hair faster than the ghoul warrior, already reaching for a fire spell in my mind. But without the aid of my staff to focus the energy of the spell more efficiently and effectively, I was a shade too slow getting it together. The ghoul came back to his feet, his claws digging at the ice, and promptly came at me with my own damn staff, whirling it like he knew how to use it. I let out a yelp and started dodging. If we'd been standing on the street, he'd have tenderized me into a pulpy mess that he'd barely need to chew. But we weren't standing on the street. We fought in the frozen Arctic air of the little store coated in winter ice. The ice betrayed him at every movement, forcing him to constantly keep his balance in check, while to the winter night it was as smooth and safe as a dance studio's floor. I ducked around empty clothes racks, dumping a couple of them at the ghoul as he came at me, hoping to knock him down and change direction constantly, hoping to open the gap between us or force him to lose his balance. All I needed was a portion of a second to bring another spell into play and end the fight. Problem was, the ghoul knew it. He came at me smart and fast and balanced. And as long as he could keep doing it, he had me in a stalemate. All he had to do was hold me until his friends either ripped through the wall or loped around it, and I was done. Stars and stones, I was missing my force rings right about then. And my blasting rod and shield bracelet and every other little magical craft tool I'd ever designed. But when my lab and its accompanying gear had been destroyed, it had severely cut down my options on what I could manufacture, and being stuck out on the island the whole winter, with harshly limited resources, limited by what my brother could round up and bring on a boat, I'd not yet had a chance to set up anything as elaborate and as extensively personalized as a new lab. I'd managed the staff and the wooden skull, working at a laboriously glacial pace, but practically all I'd had to work with was a small set of knives and some sandpaper left over from the construction of the What's-Up dock. Preparation. Damn it, Harry. The key to survival as a wizard is preparation. I could hear sledgehammer blows being delivered to my ice wall, and though I couldn't see it in the fog, I could hear the change of pitch in each impact as the ice began to crack and shatter.
Oh, God!
Harvey shouted in panic. I couldn't see him either, and I'd forgotten about him for a second. He was probably right where I'd left him, within a few feet of the wall, and able to see exactly what was happening. The other two ghouls were coming through. Something inside me started screaming, along with poor Harvey. It was time for a desperate risk. I abruptly shifted direction and charged the warrior ghoul. My staff flickered at my head. I raised my left arm to block, trying to take the blow on the meaty muscle of my forearm. Though I didn't feel any pain, the impact sent a flash of white light across my vision. My duster's sleeve caught some of the blow, but not much. Its defensive spells were really meant to slow and disperse fast-moving objects like bullets, or to stop the penetration of sharp things. A big, blunt instrument had no subtlety, but it was merry hell to defend against. I found myself inside the quarterstaff's reach and promptly slammed my head against the end of the ghoul's muzzle. He let out a yowl of surprise and anger, his forward momentum abruptly stalled, and I followed up with a one-armed push using every bit of muscle the winter mantle could muster. The ghoul staggered back several steps, and then his feet went out from under him. Hope sparked and kindled will. As the ghoul fell, I let out a triumphant howl of, "Infriga!" Winter howled into the little store for the fifth time in maybe 60 seconds, blanketing the fallen ghoul warrior in absolute cold and boiling fog. I panted frantically for a couple of seconds, until the fog boiled away enough to let me see the warrior ghoul in its frozen sarcophagus. "Harvey!" I croaked. "Harvey! Sound off!"
"Oh, God!"
Harvey sobbed.
"Oh, God!"
"Yeah, or that," I muttered and hurried toward the sound. I reached him just as the other two ghouls pounded their way through the wall.
Harvey let out a shockingly high-pitched squealing sound and scrambled in helpless panic on the slippery ice. I raised my frost-coated right hand, gathered my will for another spell, and found a patch of white blankness in front of my eyes. I blinked, and suddenly I was sitting on the ice next to Harvey, wondering how I'd gotten down there. Winter, I realized. I'd called up too much power, too fast, with too little chance to rest. I'd burned up my reserves of magical energy to the point where it threatened to rob me of consciousness. But even now, I didn't feel magically exhausted. Of course you don't feel it, dummy. You're the winter knight. I blinked a couple of times, and then looked down at my left arm, which was sending me some sort of odd pulsing sensation. My duster's sleeve was being distended from the inside by something pointy. It took me an effort of conscious observation and logical processing to realize that it was my own broken arm. A 7-foot section of the ice wall suddenly shattered and fell to the floor with a groan. I shoved myself to my feet with my good arm as the other two warrior ghouls came through the opening. No magic, no weapons, no options. I set my teeth in a defiant, futile snarl, and the ghouls pounced. Chapter 19. Both ghouls came at me as the most dangerous target in sight, ignoring the sobbing Harvey. I didn't blame them. I'd have made the same call. All three of us were wrong. The warrior ghouls came at me from different angles, so that I could have nailed only one of them, even if I'd had the energy to call up another blast of winter. It meant that one ghoul had to bound to one side and then rush me. The other one just leapt over Harvey's screaming figure. Goodman Gray killed that one first. As the ghoul passed over him, Harvey's eyes went cold and calm, and one arm swept out. I didn't see it actually change as much as I had an impression that the arm was, for a second, in an entirely different shape, a hard, inward-curving sickle moving with fantastic speed. There was a shearing sound combined with a thunk, like a schoolroom paper cutter, but wetter and meatier. And suddenly the ghoul's top and bottom halves were spinning off on separate arcs. Then the second ghoul was on top of me, and even with the extra strength of the winter mantle, it was everything I could do to keep its teeth off my throat. If it hadn't been for my duster, its claws would have shredded my torso in the second it took Gray to reach me. There was a sense of motion more than anything I could actually see. And something vaguely gorilla-like seized the ghoul in enormous hands and threw him away from me with such power that I heard joints dislocating from the force of the throw. The ghoul hit a still-standing portion of the wall of ice and went right through it, splattering fluids in the process. Before it had gone all the way through the wall, a blur that reminded me of some kind of big hunting cat hit it in midair and bore it to the ground, out of sight behind the fog and the rubble of the wall. The ghoul let out a single, weak, gurgling scream. Then it went quiet. Something moved on the other side of the wall. A few seconds later, there was a long exhalation, and Goodman Gray appeared, stepping calmly over what was left of the wall. Something was twitching in death on the floor beyond him, though I couldn't make out any details, and didn't want to. Ghouls don't die easy, and they don't go out anyway but messy. The one he'd bisected was making scrabbling noises from two different directions in the fog. He looked around for a moment, pursed his lips and nodded, and said, "Good move, splitting them up like that, and in the fog, too. Smart. Don't see that much in people your age." "There's always more of them than me," I said, and got to my feet. I had a feeling that I didn't want to be sitting on the ground, bleeding, with a broken arm around Goodman Gray. You don't give predators like that ideas. And at that moment, the casually dressed, unremarkable-looking little guy was scaring me more than had the ghouls and Tessa together. I kept any tremor out of my voice and asked, "Where's Harvey?"
"Over here," Gray said. He looked exactly as relaxed as he had before, as if he had just paused to throw away an empty paper cup rather than tearing two ghouls to shreds. His eyes lingered on my wounded arm. I only had a few seconds to make the switch, and he wouldn't quiet down. I had to knock him out. I gave him a hard look. Then I took a couple of steps to the frozen ghoul who had taken my staff from me and reached down to wrench it free of the winter ice. It crumbled for me obligingly, yielding the tool back into my hand. A couple of the ghoul's clawed fingers broke off and came with it. I shook them off of it with a grimace, turned to Gray, and said, "Show me." He lifted his eyebrows at me for a moment. He might have smiled a bit, but nodded and waved for me to follow him. He didn't seem in the least worried about turning his back on me. Hell's bells. For all I knew, the shapeshifter had eyes in the back of his head. Gray led me to the side of the sales floor, where old metal frame shelves had once held magazines. He grabbed one and hauled it easily aside. Harvey Morrison's corpse lay on the other side. His throat had been cut neatly by something sharp. There was an unholy mess on the floor around him. His eyes were open and staring sightlessly up at the ceiling. The blood was still pulsing out, though he was white enough that I knew that it was too late. He was dead. His body was still figuring it out. I lifted my eyes slowly to Gray. The shapeshifter stared down at Harvey with a very faint frown on his face. He looked up at me and said, "Huh, awkward. You think this is funny?" I asked him. I knew my voice sounded hot. "I think it stinks," Gray said, and looked back at Harvey. "I only choked him out." "You would say that, though, if you were trying to screw me over." "No, I wouldn't," Gray said. "I'd tell you I cut his cowardly throat because it was simpler." "You would? It's not as if you frightened me, Dresden. Lying well takes a lot of effort, and it gets old after a few centuries. Mostly I don't bother." He nudged Harvey's shoulder with the toe of his shoe. "But someone went to a lot of effort to get this done. Did it fast. Got out just as fast." "Where's Deirdre?" I asked. "She was supposed to be chasing her mother away after you bloodied her nose for her." He knelt down on the floor beside Harvey and then leaned closer, inhaling through his nose like a hound. "Ugh," he considered for a moment. "Too much fresh blood and damn ghoul stench. Can't get anything through it." He looked up at me. "What about you?" If I had 24 hours to collect gear and another 5 or 6 to go over the place, maybe I could turn up something, I said. We looked at each other. I think we were both thinking that the other one wasn't telling us something he knew. Except that I was actually ignorant, whereas I was pretty sure Gray had sent it more than he let on. But he struck me as the suspicious sort. Evidently, Gray had me figured the same way. He let out an impatient sigh. "Wizard, you know I'm telling you the truth, right?" "Right," I said. "Sure you are. We're a trustworthy bunch of Boy Scouts." That got what almost looked like a genuine wry smile out of him. He leaned down and closed Harvey's eyes with one hand, the motion almost respectful. In the same gesture, he ran his fingers through the thickening puddle of blood. "What are you doing?" I asked. "Getting what we came for," he said. "Gotta have the blood sample for what's coming up. You'll have to tell Nicodemus where I am." "And where's that?" "Morrison Fiduciary Services for the rest of the day," he said. The point of not killing Harvey was to avoid the possibility that he'd be noticed if he went missing. So he's about to not go missing. "You're going to fake being a confidential and knowledgeable financial expert to people you've never met before for the rest of the day?" I asked him, my voice heavy with sarcasm. "Yes," Gray said calmly. I felt my eyebrows going up. "You're that good?" "I'm better," he said. His eyes glinted weirdly, and it made me shudder. "What about Harvey's body?" "He didn't have any family, and you've got 2 ghouls on ice," he said. "Leave them where they are. They'll take care of them for us when they thaw out." That made me grind my teeth. Maybe I should take them out now. Those guys were different than the usual ghoul. I don't feel like giving them a second shot at me. "Whatever," Gray said. "I need to get moving." Gray started lapping the fresh blood out of his cupped hand. He grimaced and then shuddered, and a second later, He looked exactly like the corpse at his feet, clothes and all. He leaned over and took Harvey's glasses out of his shirt pocket. He wiped the blood off them on a corner of Harvey's shirt and then put them on.
Better get someone to look at that arm, eh?
I eyed my broken arm distractedly and then said, Gray?
Yeah?
I'm not leaving Harvey's body to be eaten by ghouls. And if you've got a problem with that, then we can discuss it right now. Gray looked at me with Harvey's face and then nodded once.
Your call. You do it.
And he padded off through the rapidly thinning fog toward the opening I'd blasted in the store's window and vanished onto the street. I looked down at Harvey's corpse. Then I said, I'm sorry. It seemed inadequate. I was going to promise him that I would punish his murderer, but Harvey was beyond that now. The dead don't need justice. That's for those of us who are left looking down at the remains. I pushed the heavy shelves back in front of Harvey's body. The authorities would probably find him in a couple of days. It wasn't dignified, but there wasn't a lot more that I could do. And I really didn't feel like making a run on Hades' vault, only to find a batch of mythological badasses waiting to kill us all the moment we came in. So I did what I could. I didn't have much left in the way of a magical punch, but I did have the strength of my good arm and a big heavy stick. I used them to shatter the frozen ghouls into chunks, and then I left the store too, and shambled back out to the rental car, feeling tired and sick and useless. Chapter 20. I wasn't sure where I was driving. The important thing was to drive. Some part of me was noting with more than a little alarm that I was not behaving in any kind of rational fashion. The numbers weren't adding up. I had a badly broken arm. We were on the clock. I had left Karen by herself among that crew, though I felt fairly sure that Asher and Binder wouldn't kill her out of hand, and that Nicodemus had no good reason to do so. Yet. But I had only Gray's word that he had gone where he said he meant to go. For all I knew, he'd doubled back to the warehouse to indulge his interest in Karen. Unlikely, maybe, but I still didn't like the idea of leaving her there. On the other hand, I couldn't go back either. Not with my arm hurt like that. Showing weakness to that crew was not an option. I checked to be sure that my arm wasn't bleeding. It wasn't, but I nearly crashed into a car that had come to a stop in front of me while I was looking. Whatever the mantle of the winter night did for me, the damage was catching up to me now. Maybe I couldn't feel the pain, but the mantle had to draw its energy from something, and the most logical source was me. The pain didn't hurt, but it was still being caused by a very real injury, and covering that pain was costing me in exhaustion and focus. I needed help. Right. Help. I should drive to Butters, get him to set the arm and splint it. But instead, I found myself parking the car in front of a pretty, simple, colonial home in Bucktown. It was a lovely house, unpretentious and carefully maintained. There was a large oak tree out front, a couple more in the back, and a freshly painted white picket fence surrounding the front yard. A new mailbox, handmade and hand-carved, rested on a post beside the fence's gate. Metallic gold lettering on the mailbox's side read, The Carpenters. I put the car in park and eyed the house nervously. I hadn't been there since my last trip to Chicago the year before. I'd stopped by when I'd been pretty sure no one was home, like a big old coward, to collect my dog, Mouse, for a secret mission. Doing so had permitted me to craftily dodge my first meeting with my daughter, since I'd carried her from the blood-soaked temple in Chichen Itza, from the deaths of thousands of vampires of the Red Court, and from her mother's body, dead by my hand. Her name was Maggie. She had dark hair and eyes just like Susan, her mother. Beautiful Susan, who I'd failed, just like I'd failed Harvey. And after that, I'd taken Molly Carpenter out and gotten her involved with some of the most dangerous beings I knew. Because she'd been helping me, Molly had fallen prey to the power games of the She, and now, for all I knew, she wasn't even truly human anymore.
Molly, who I'd failed, just like I'd failed Harvey. What the hell was I doing here? I left the car and shambled up to the gate. After a brief pause, I opened it and continued to the front door. I knocked, wondering who might be home. It was the middle of the day. The kids would all be in school. For a second, I debated fleeing, driving away. What was I hoping to accomplish here? What could I possibly do here that would make victory in my trench off with Nicodemus any more likely? It was wholly against reason. I stood on the front porch of Michael Carpenter's house, and only then did I realize that I was crying, and had been for a while. Again, I considered simple childish flight, but my feet didn't move. A moment later, a good man opened the door. Michael Carpenter was well over 6 feet tall, and if he didn't have quite the same musculature he'd carried when he'd been an active Knight of the Cross, he still looked like he could take most men apart without breaking a sweat. His brown hair was more deeply threaded with silver than it had been before, and his beard was even more markedly grizzled. There were a few more lines on his face, especially around the eyes and mouth. Smile lines, I thought. He wore jeans and a blue flannel work shirt, and he walked with the aid of a cane. He'd gotten the injury, fighting beside me, because I hadn't acted fast enough to prevent it. I'd failed Michael, too. My view of him went watery and vague and fuzzed out completely.
"I think I need help,"
I heard myself whisper, voice little more than a rasp.
"I think I'm lost."
There was not an instant's hesitation in his answer or in his deep, gentle voice. "Come in," my friend said. I felt something break in my chest and let out a single sob that came out sounding like a harsh, strangled groan. I sat down at Michael's kitchen table. Michael's house had a big kitchen that looked neater and a lot less cluttered than the last time I'd seen it. There were two big pantries necessary for the provisioning of his platoon-sized family. The table could seat a dozen without putting the leaves in. I squinted around. The whole place looked neater and better organized, though it had always been kept scrupulously clean. Michael took note of my gaze and smiled quietly. "Fewer people occupying the same space," he said. There was both pride and regret in his voice. "It's true, you know. They grow up fast." He went to the fridge, pulled out a couple of beers in plain brown bottles, and brought them back to the table. He used a bottle opener shaped like Thor's warhammer, Mjolnir, to open them. I picked up the bottle opener and read the inscription on it. "Whosoever holds this hammer, if he be worthy, shall wield the power of Thor, or at least to crack open a beer." Michael grinned. We clinked bottles and drank a pull, and I put my arm up on the table. He took one look at my sleeve and exhaled slowly. Then he said, "Let me help." I eased out of my duster with his aid, my arm and wrist flickering with silvery twinges of sensation as the sleeve came off. Then I eyed my arm. The bone hadn't actually come out of the skin, but it looked like it would only take a little push to make it happen. My forearm was swollen up like a sausage. The area around the upraised bone was purple and blotchy, and something that looked like blisters had come up on my skin. Michael took my arm and laid it out straight on the table. He began to prod it gently with his fingertips. "Radial fracture," he said quietly. "You're a doctor now." "I was a medical corpsman when I served," he replied. "Saw plenty of breaks." He looked up and said, "You don't want to go to the hospital, I take it." I shook my head. "Of course not," he said. He prodded some more. "I think it's a clean break. Can you set it?" "Maybe," he said. "But without imaging equipment, I'll have to do it by feel. It could heal crookedly if I'm not good enough." "I'd kill most of that equipment just by walking into the room with it," I said. He nodded. "We'll have to immobilize the wrist right away once it's done." "Don't know if I can afford that." "You can't not afford it," he replied bluntly. "Assuming I get it set, one twist of your hand will shift the bone at the break. You've got to immobilize and protect it, or the ends will just grind together instead of healing." I winced. "Can you do a cast?" There's too much swelling, he said. We'll have to splint it and wait for the swelling to go down before it can take a proper cast. I could call Dr. Butters. I flinched at the suggestion. He's sort of wary of me right now. And you know how much he doesn't like working on living people. Michael frowned at me for a moment, studying my face carefully. Then he said, I see. He nodded and said,